First of all, let me ask a question. How is it going with the lab? I saw that it looks like it's going well from my eyes, walking and everyone busy on your laptop. But please let me know if there is anything. I mean, I know that I'm very confident with the two TAs, but if it is the structure of the lab or things of material that you feel should really be covered in the lab that we are missing, please let me know. So you can even make a comment now, or you send me an email, and both me and the 3TA are just trying to do our best to have this class going as smooth as possible. So, but please let us know. Another thing is that we posted the first homework on the website, and I just want to clarify that you don't need to turn the homework to me. Independently, if you do or if you don't, your grade will not be based on this homework in any way. So the only reason why we posted the homework and we put the deadline is for you to basically to work through by yourself, with your friends. We're going to do a little bit in the lab. It's just to basically make you do the work and to understand the material. Now, if you want to turn the homework, we will look at what you have done. It will give you feedback. But even if you do a total disaster, I promise you, I don't even remember the names. So, or you can put it like you just can give me back without name. But then I don't know how to give you back. So anyway, I promise you, I just don't worry about it. And now one thing also we will do is, I think the deadline is February 7th. It's on the website. So just past the deadline, and we will also post the solution. And so you can also see how it should have been done. But please do it, because one thing I will not be flexible is that if in the midterm there will be panics or questions about things that be covered in the homework. So I strongly recommend that you to do it. So I also saw that you're just plotting out a correlation function. So so that means that you're getting familiar. So what I'm going to do with the lecture today, so this is where we are. So I introduced a longitudinal data set. We went through of how to plot longitudinal data. And we quit the class last Wednesday, briefly going through the definition of the autocorrelation function. And as general, I mean, in lab, I know you're going to be a little bit ahead of what is in the lecture, but that's fine. I mean, if you actually do it first and then understand what it is, actually, it's not always a bad thing. So I'm going to finish the explorative analysis this morning. Plus, I'm going to spend the second part of the class doing a brief review of a linear regression model and some of the key concepts, a key definition. Just because it's important that everyone is on the same page on a certain terminology. So then when we introduce the linear regression model for longitudinal data, everyone feels comfortable. So with respect to the autocorrelation function, to explore the correlation structure, so what we do, first we calculate the residual. So we remove from the outcome variable the effect of all our covariates, including time. So Xij, it's broadly representing the several covariates that we have available plus time. We calculate the residuals, Rij, which is the observed outcome minus by beta at Xij, we mean the fitted value under the standard linear regression model. And now, you can estimate a autocorrelation function only when you have data collected at a fixed number of equally spaced points. In fact, I had a discussion with one of your colleagues at the end of the class last Wednesday, and actually I didn't remember if you have to have equally spaced points, and actually you have to. So only if you have the balanced data, everyone is measured at the same time, and the data are equally spaced, then you can calculate the scatter plot matrix, which basically every pair, all the pair of the residuals are plotted one against each other. And from the scatter plot matrix, you can calculate the autocorrelation function. So just give you the example. What we did, we took the CD4 data set. We kind of rounded the observation. We know that the CD4 data set is actually one of which is one of these data sets which is more messy, where we do not have everyone is observed at the same time point, but we kind of rounded the observation and forced the outcome to be everyone observed at times minus 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then what we did, we calculated the residuals and we plot all the distinct pair of residuals corresponding to each lag difference. So the red boxes are all, for example, the first box, this one, it's basically the residuals at times minus 1 versus the residuals at times minus 2. So these are residuals plotted against each other, which have only 1 year apart. Similar thing, this is again red because it's a residual times 0 versus a residual times minus 1, 1 year difference, residuals at times 1 and 0 and so on. So all the red boxes are the residuals, the two pair of residuals plotted against each other, which have only 1 year apart. Okay? The number of dots are the number of subjects that you have in the study. Okay? So each person has a residual times minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. And then what we did on the red blocks, we just plot the residuals which have 1 year apart. And then for in the orange boxes, so we plot the residuals that have 2 years apart. The yellow boxes are the residuals that we plot the residuals that are 3 years apart. Now, there are a couple of things that we have to notice. First of all, if you look at the correlation, so at the association of the dots within the red boxes, and you compare of the correlation within the orange boxes and the yellow boxes, it looks like that the correlation from these boxes is higher than the correlation in the orange boxes and the correlation in the yellow boxes. Can you see that? Right? So there is a higher association on the sets of points, which is what we expect. You would expect that the residuals that are only 1 year apart are more similar to each other than the residuals that are 2 years apart, than the residuals that have 3 years apart. So, observation number one, the correlation is stronger at lag one, then at lag two, and then at lag three. Observation number two, if you look at just try to compare. Now, focus, for example, let's focus here, okay, only on this row. And if you kind of visually look at the number of points you have in the box, you see, this looks, okay, so definitely the correlation here is lower than here, okay? But then the second point is that the number of dots here are much lower than the number of dots here. You kind of see the same, right? So remember, what is this? These are the residuals plotted against each other between minus 2 and 3. So these are the residuals which are 5 years apart. Okay? You can see it? Minus 2 versus 3, right? So these are residuals which are plotted for 5 years apart. It means that you have a dropout. It means that you have subjects that don't stay as long as the 5 years. So then when you're going to look at a lag 5, you have less number of subjects to estimate this correlation than when you estimate the correlation simply at lag 1, okay? So two things. One, the correlation at lag 1 is higher, and the correlation actually tends to diminish as the lag increases. Two is the number of subjects under which you estimate a correlation is lower for larger lags. And that tends to be an unusual phenomenon, right? Because unless you have everybody stay in the study for the entire period, generally you tend to lose people as you move along, right? So the usual situation is that people drop out of your study. So from this scatter plot matrix, we can estimate the autocorrelation function. And you already know how to do it. She was showing you this morning. How you estimate the autocorrelation function? Well, it's pretty simple. The autocorrelation function is the correlation that is estimated at each lag. So you estimate the correlation at lag 1 by taking the correlation within each of the red boxes and average up. You estimate the correlation along the two by estimating the correlation with each of the orange boxes and average out, and so on. So I'm just going to show you the what we have here. So this one, it's simply a numerical representation of your scatter plot matrix. So the number I circled with red are the estimated correlation within each of your red boxes. Okay? So you remember your first box on top, the red boxes on top, the correlation is 0.66, 0.49. So these are all the correlations between the residuals at log 1. You take all this number, you calculate the average, and you get a 0.6. Then you have the correlation within each of the orange boxes. So these are all the estimated correlation along the two. And so you have a 0.56, 47, 51, blah, blah, blah. The correlation is 0.54. These are the yellow, and it's 0.46. And then you take this correlation. You average this correlation, or you average this correlation. You see, actually, at log 6, you have just one, which is 0.89. And you say, oh, wow, that is a large number. Well, remember that my second observation, that the correlation at log 6 comes only from this box here. Okay? And in fact, that's where you have very few people. So this is why it's important to not only apply blindly some, you know, software program, but also look at the data, okay? So you have, it's true that you have a 0.89 from this box, which is a correlation which is very high, a log 6, but it's also that these estimates are highly unreliable because you have much less number of subjects than what you have used here, okay? So again, to estimate the autocorrelation function at log 1, we calculate the correlation here, 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 and average out. Autocorrelation at log 2, you calculate the correlation here, 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 and average out, and so on, right? So that's how you get this matrix. From this matrix, at each log, you get a number, and that's how you had an estimate of the autocorrelation function. So at log 1, so 1 year apart, the autocorrelation is 0.6. At log 2 is 0.54. At log 3 is 0.46, and so on. And then you have this high number at log 6. Okay. So one thing that we can do to account for the fact that you might have different numbers of data points in the different block of your scatter plot matrix, you can estimate not only, you can come up not only with the point estimates of the autocorrelation function, but also as a measure of uncertainty of your autocorrelation function. And so one rule of thumb, it's basically to have a confidence band that is equal to 1 divided the square root of n. N is the number of independent pairs that you have in that box, okay? And so smaller the number, larger will be the uncertainty associated with that lag-specific estimate of the autocorrelation function. So that means that I can plot the autocorrelation function, which is each of these values versus the lag, but I can also plot the measure of uncertainty associated with each of these numbers. And the measure uncertainty associated with the red boxes will be lower because you have a higher number of pairs of residuals at log 1. And the measure of uncertainty at log 6 will be much higher because you have a much lower number of independent pair at log 6. Okay. So show you the plot. So here it is. So this is the The solid line is the what we call sampled autocorrelation function for the CD4 cells. Now remember, we kind of cheated here because the CD4 data set, it's not equally spaced, but we rounded it just to make the point. So you see the autocorrelation function, it's a measure of the correlation plotted versus the lag. And so remember, just you have the little table, it's 0.6 at lag 1, 0.54 at lag 2, 0.45, I don't remember, lag 3, and so on. But then you have that a lag 6 picks up. But also what I plot here is the 1 divided the square root of n, which is the measure of uncertainty. And so what it's telling you is that you are pretty confident about this part of the autocorrelation function because the uncertainty is low. You are much less confident about this part of the autocorrelation function because the uncertainty is much higher. And you will need to plot autocorrelation functions all the time because that's how you will get a sense of what is the autocorrelation structure, you know, the correlation structure in your data. But never look blindly to a plot, okay? Now you have this theta function, I'll call it an autocore.ado, right? And it will give you a plot, but look, calculate also the scatter plot metrics and also have this confidence band so you can critically evaluate what are these estimates of the autocorrelation function that are reliable and the one that are less. But basically what he's telling you is that the autocorrelation indicated that it's getting lower and lower when you move from lag 1 to lag 4. After that, you really don't have enough data to conclude, you know, what's going on. Now, the autocorrelation, yeah. What you do? Yeah. So that's where I'm going next. It's called variogram. So, in fact, I was going to say that, so the autocorrelation function is if you have equally spaced data, balanced data, piece of cake. You know what to do, right? You calculate this scatter plot metric, you calculate this autocorrelation function, you calculate the uncertainty in the autocorrelation function, and then you have a nice graphical display of you know, how the correlation decay. And you will see that these are very important then to identify which regression model we want to use to do our estimation. So the autocorrelation function will be a way to guide us how we should model the correlation. First of all, it will be a way to tell us, is there a correlation at all? Okay? So don't forget that one situation we could have here would be the autocorrelation function was 0.1 and flat. In this way, the data are independent, right? So you can have no autocorrelation at all, some autocorrelation that vary with time, autocorrelation doesn't vary with the lag, autocorrelation doesn't vary with the lag. So in a visual inspection of the autocorrelation function can tell, you know, it's very informative with respect to the model. Now, I've been constantly asked, well, what happens if we don't have equally spaced and balanced data? You know, can I estimate the autocorrelation function? Well, you can if you do as we have done with the CD4, you know, which you force the data to do that. But actually, there is a better alternative, which is called the variogram. Now, the variogram, it's basically allow you to describe associations among repeated observation time, okay? So it's basically a more general it's a more general tool to estimate and to represent the correlation as a function of the lag, even when you have irregular time. And basically, I call it gamma u, and it's defined as half of the square differences between the observed time, between the observed response at time t and the response at time t minus u. So basically, what you do, and I'm sorry, this is, so yt, it's a random variable, so is the random response that occurs at time t, and E is the expected value. So basically the definition is you take the difference between yt and yt minus u, use the lag, the square difference, you take the expected value over all the possible realization and take one out. Now this is the theoretical definition, okay, so don't be too scared. Now, More simply, the barogram, and I'll tell you in a moment how to estimate it. I'll just give you the definition of a barogram based on a random variable yt, which vary with time. Now, the barogram is strictly related with the autocorrelation function. So rho of u is the autocorrelation function. It has this form, where sigma squared is the total variance of the data. So the barogram is defined by is defined as the total variance of sigma squared, so sigma squared is the variance of your outcome, times 1 minus the autocorrelation function. So by definition, the autocorrelation function vary between 1 and 0 because it's measured a correlation. So the correlation can be as high as 1. Of course, unlike 0, the autocorrelation function will be 1 because you calculate the correlation with respect, you know, of each point with respect to itself. And generally, the autocorrelation tends to decay as the lag increases. Okay? Well, the barogram is extending the autocorrelation function. And by this definition, it means that when the autocorrelation function is 0, the barogram, so this quantity is 1. So when the autocorrelation function is, when the autocorrelation function is 1, let me start again. When the lag is 0, okay, when the lag is 0, the autocorrelation function is 1. So a lag 0, the barogram is equal to sigma squared, okay? And then because it's 1 minus, if the autocorrelation function decay as the lag increase, the barogram increase as the lag increase because it's, you know, I'm taking 1 minus the autocorrelation function. Okay? So when you visually inspect the barogram, it's slightly different than when you visually look an estimated autocorrelation function because if the correlation gets lower as the lag increases, the barogram will increase, right? Whereas the autocorrelation function decays. So this is the definition. Now, why? How we estimate the barogram? Okay. So it's a function of our famous residual. Okay? So now we have again with the residual Rij at time Tij. Now remember, because now everyone, you know, because we have unbalanced data, irregular data, you have to think that every subject will have his own pair of time. Okay, so it's not as before that everything was measured at time minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. Now you have subject 1, which is measured at 3 months, 6 months, 8 months, right? And subject 2 is measured 1 month, 5 months, and 12 months. So each subject has its own time difference, okay? So you have to do two things. One, you calculate the uijk, which is the time difference between visit j and visit k for subject I. Okay? And so every time you have equally spaced points, you have a fixed set of lags. Like 1, like 2, like 3. But now, if everyone is measured at different times, you don't have a common set of lag for everybody. Everyone has its own lag, okay? Which is U, I, J, K. Okay? And then, correspondence to the U, I, J, K, you calculate V, I, J, K, which is 1/2 of the square difference. Okay. Let's have a very simple example. If I can have my cord long enough. Okay. So let's assume that you have a subject 1, okay, which is a measure of the 2 months, 3 months, and 5 months. Okay? So let's call this a subject I, and it's measured at time 1, at time 2, and at time 3. okay? And then he has, for the same subject I, he has, you know, three values of your residuals. So you will have a residuals for the subject I at time one, a residuals for subject I at time two, and the residuals for subject I at time three, right? So then what you do, you have to estimate to calculate y I at time one and two, which will be the difference between 3 months and 2 months. So this will be 1 month. And then you will measure yi 1, 3, which is the difference between 5 months and 1 month, which is 4 months. And then you can have yi 2, 3, which is 5 minus 3, 2 months. And then you will have all the square difference. You will have 1/2 ri2 minus ri1 squared, 1/2 ri3 minus ri1 squared, and then you have 1/2 ri3 minus ri2 squared. You guys have a sense of what I'm doing? So, so I'm taking just one subject, okay? Let me call it subject I. You have to do the same thing. So you have a subject I. Subject I is measured at 2 months, at 3 months, and at 5 months. Okay? So for that subject, you have three values of the residuals. The residuals of subject I at the first time point, residual subject I at the second time point, and residuals for subject I at the third time point. Okay? So then you have to calculate the lag for that particular subject. And the lags will be all the time differences for that particular subject. So you're going to have three lags. One is 1 month, because it's this difference. Then the second is a 4 month, which is this difference. And then you have the 2 months again, which is this difference. So you take all the possible differences at the time point for the subject. And then you take the corresponding half squared difference of the residual. Sorry, here? Here? So in the middle you take, so this is, so you basically have, you have the first difference is log one, and then you have, I'm sorry, yeah, thank you, two. Yeah, so actually he has log one, log two, log three. And so what you do, you're going to plot each of these, so you're going to have for this subject log one, log two, log three. So you're going to plot the square differences, so the three square differences in corresponding to each 3 years for that subject. Okay? And then we have the second subject. The second subject might have the definition of this U, I, J, K can be different. Different can be 1 month, 15 months, I mean, I don't know, 6 months, okay? So you're going to have this plot where you're gonna plot the D, I, J, K, which is half of the difference squared of the residuals, with respect to the corresponding U, I, J, K. So now you have a lot of dots, and then you smooth them, okay? And that is the estimate for the variance. Now, there is one more thing that you do. You estimate the total variance, which is going to be the roof of the variogram, sigma squared s. And you're going to plot, add an horizontal line in correspondence of the estimates of the variance, okay? So let me show it to you. So if you take the CD4 example again, but you don't do the trick where you round the time point, but you do the right thing, as I showed there, that is the variogram. So you see, now, for the CD4, Remember, everyone is measured at regular time between minus one year to after 4 years of seroconversion. So every person has his own series of U's, and every person has his own series of V's, okay? So we just have plotted there all the views in correspond to the views, okay, V versus views, and then we smooth it. Now on top is the estimate of the total bed. And so now you remember that when I estimated the autocorrelation function, we had the autocorrelation lag 6, which is you see here was, you know, some certain point becomes really, really high. Well, then the verogram is supposed to drop, right? Because it's one inverse of each other. Well, but it doesn't happen because the verogram is more robust, and because we smooth the data, it's less sensible, less sensitive to estimates of the autocorrelation that drive, you know, that comes from little data. So the visual inspection of this verogram teaches us a few things that you will see will become very, very important when we are going to have to choose how to model our covariance metrics. So number one is the verogram, unlike 0, does not start at 0. It starts at this value of 50,000, right? So first of all, there is this gap. And that is an indication about something very important about our data, but I'm not going to tell you that yet, okay? Second of all, the verogram increase, and that is with the lag, which is consistent with what we have observed for the autocorrelation function. It means that the autocorrelation actually diminish as the lag increase. And third, the verogram at the largest lag does not reach the total variance. There is another gap there. Okay? this other gap on the top, it means that there is an additional source of variability in our data that we cannot explain by modeling the correlation. But we will get that later. Okay? So for now, let's try to make sure you understand the verogram and how to plot it correctly. And to keep in mind that when you have a plot to the verogram, you have a checklist. Does the verogram start at 0? Does the verogram increase? Does the verogram reach the total variance? And based upon the answer to these three questions, you will have some level of comfort of how to model the correlation. Okay? And that will become clear. So take the CD4 example that you have on the data set and redo and re-estimate by yourself both the autocorrelation function and the verogram, as well as any other data set that you have posted. Now, we also estimate the verogram for the protein content of milk data set. First of all, we fit to the data what we call the saturated model. Basically, we fit a regression model to the data, allowing a different intercept at different time points, as well as for the three treatment groups, okay? And which is basically is equivalent of collapsing at each time point, taking the average of the protein content of milk across the three treatment groups. Because we estimated here verogram for all the data together. We didn't estimate the verogram for each treatment separately. And so this is the estimated verogram. You see, the estimated verogram here, it has some different feature. Again, it doesn't start at 0. It increases again. But then actually, it's even higher than the total variance. And that is actually kind of weird. And the reason why this is happening, and then we'll return to this, because if you remember in the protein content of milk, you have a lot of missing data at the end. Okay, so if you go back at the description of the data set, there is a substantial amount of missing data. So although the verogram is supposed to be more robust than the autocorrelation function, still in this particular situation, a very large lag, that estimate is quite reliable. But you can again conclude by visually inspecting the verogram that you have that they are the correlation between the repeated measurement of protein content of milk tends to get lower and lower as the time difference increase. And in fact, if you remember, for the protein content of milk, you didn't have equally spaced measurements. You have that was measured at different weeks, but then the difference between the weeks was not was not always the same. So now I'm skipping what you have in your slides with a general serial covariance model, because I'm going to turn back to this later. So to recap, for exploratory data analysis, so you have seen several tools for exploring the data in terms of understanding the time effect, understanding if there is a tracking phenomenon, plotting spaghetti plots, or doing the zap plots, looking at the autocorrelation function, and when you cannot, looking at the variogram. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to switch gear for a moment and talking a little less about data and a little more about just statistical theory, okay? And so what I'm going to do, I just want to review what these are. So this is the large chapter of what we're going to do in the next two to three weeks, okay? So basically what we're going to do now is how you use statistical models for analyzing longitudinal data when your outcome is continuous. Okay, so we have, so that's why I call it linear models for longitudinal data. So we have our outcome, yij, measure different subjects over time, and we want to generally look at the effect of the covariance on your outcome, and then we want to take into account of the correlation of the repeated measurements. So before going to, so this is what we call the general linear models for correlated data. But now, before I go into the general linear model for correlated data, there is a series of things I want to make sure everyone kind of know as a clear in their mind, okay? So I actually, this morning, I made a list of my 5 points, okay? So I'm going to review these points here. However, if you, when you leave the class, you are unclear, you're not prepared about this, you have all, I would say all this week to review this material from your previous course, okay? So starting Wednesday, and more importantly Monday, I'm assuming that you have a very clear on your mind these red points, because these have been covered quite extensively in the 620 and the 650 series. So, but I will review it here, so we are sure that, you are focused on what is important to know. So the basic matrix algebra, there is also a little handout posted on the website, and I don't know if you have covered it in lab, but it's important that everyone is a little familiar with basic matrix algebra, otherwise you get completely lost when I explain the concept here. Everyone should have a clear in mind what is a likelihood function and a sampling distribution, and I repeated it here. Again, what is a normal distribution. Everyone should be very familiar with what is a linear regression model and what is ordinal least square. Okay, so I'm going to redo it now, but again, I'm assuming after today that we are all talking more or less the same language, accent on the side, of course. So a regression analysis, okay? So what are the goals of regression analysis? Well, we do a regression model generally because we want to do some kind of estimation, because we want to do some testing, and we want to do some prediction. And most of the course, of this course, is focused on estimation. So we are mostly, to elaborate on this point, we might be more interested in estimating the effect on one variable, your covariate. It could be an exposure, it can be a treatment called the predictor of interest. After you adjust the control for other measure variables, because you want to remove confounding variables, or because you want to remove bias, okay? So in epidemiological terms, when we think about a predictor of interest. A predictor of interest is the exposure. And then you have other covariates that you include in the model because that could be confounder, right? The definition of confounder is a variable which is associated with your exposure and the outcome, but it is not in the causal pathway. And that's how you, you know, generally model a regression model. So if you do estimation and you calculate properly the standard error of your estimated regression coefficient, sometimes we also do testing to test the hypothesis if a particular regression coefficient is equal to zero, larger than zero, or smaller than zero. Or another goal that we might be interested to do prediction. Okay, given a set of covariates, given new sets of covariates, what is going to be the predicted value of my outcome? So, in general, when we talk about regression analysis, that's how we tend to classify the different variables. This is not a written in stone terminology. Terminology changes, depends on the field, it depends on your structure, depends on many other things. So, but at least I hope to define a common ground of terminology. So we generally talk about our response variable. In this course, the response variable will be always denoted by a Y. Okay? So this is the one thing I think I'm consistent most of the time, which is our what we call dependent variable or outcome variable. Then we have the predictor of interest that most of the time is denoted by an X. Sometimes I call it simply T if the only predictor of interest is time. Sometimes, you know, our interest is really to say how my outcome vary with time, right? So it can be an exposure variable or it can be a treatment assignment. Then we have what we call the confounding variables, and that's sometimes our X2, you know, sometimes I build in a different way, it depends on the application, which are basically associated with the responses with the predictor of interest, and they are not in the causal pathway, not in intermediate between the exposure and the final outcome. And then there is also what we call the precision variable. So these are used less often in the general, especially in the introductory course. Basically, these are variables that are associated with the response, but not with the predictor of interest. Sometimes there is a very large literature in statistics which are called surrogate outcomes. And I'm sure many of you come across very often where you have a gold standard for your response that you would like to measure, but the gold standard is even very expensive and very hard. And so you measure something else that you think it's a surrogate that predicts your gold standard very well. Okay? So these are the different, broad classification. So let's think about an example just to make sure everyone is thinking on the same way, okay? So let's assume we want to look at the impact of maternal smoking on the low birth, okay? And we have, these are the variables they're measuring. Again, this is a test for you guys, okay? I'm not going to give you the answer. So we measure birth weight, maternal smoking, year, yes or no, maternal age in years, maternal weight at last menses in kilograms, race, history of premature labor, and history of hypertension, okay? And so the scientific interest is, what is the impact of maternal smoking on low birth? So which of these variables is our outcome variable? Okay. Are you louder? Birth weight. Okay. So that is our response. Now, this is our predictor of interest. That's easy. I know that I'm gonna fall. I'm sorry, I was just too concentrated not to break my neck. I'm sorry, what was the answer? Yeah, well, that's easy, right? Okay, now, So now it's getting interesting. So, and I know there are a lot of epidemiologists here. So, so what are the confounders? Maternal age, I call it Z, okay, Z1. Race. Maternal age, we said, so I call it Z1 and Z2. Maternal weight. So is maternal weight a confounder? Let's think about it. Well, it is associated with low birth, but is maternal weight associated with smoking? I mean, would, right? So it's an intermediate verb. See, epidemiologist teaching you. You sound like John Summit. Scare me, you know? It is. Now, what is the precision? What is a precision variable? History of premature labor is definitely, it's definitely, yeah, it is a precision. Now I have on my, see, it's not always, I have actually, I've done it at some point, that precision was also maternal weight at the last month, because thinking the maternal weight at the last month is a sort, I mean, if a woman is very light, it is a predictor of low birth, but that's not necessary. Well, but it could be that also that the woman has a low body weight because she is a smoker. So there is not a clear cut. So anyway, but this is the kind of thinking that it's important to do all the time and to understand what are also the mechanisms behind the data that we are collecting. So, having said that, I'm just going to start with a little bit of the notation, okay? So I'm going to use, this is the notation that we will use through the entire course, okay? So small y, ij are our measurements. I have the j equal 1 to n. J is the time point. Because I have n, which doesn't depend on I, now for simplicity, I'm just assuming that everyone is measured the same number of times. I goes from 1 to m, so we should denote the subject. So we have m independent subjects. Each subject is measured n times. TJs are the corresponding times at which the measurements are taken on each unit. You see, the notation, I have a TJ, I don't have an I, because I here is redundant. Everyone is measured at time 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it's T1, T2, T3, T4, T5. Okay? Now, X, I, J, K. Okay? So this is a notation where we assume that each subject as a measure covariate at time j, and k are just the different number of explanatory variables that we measure. So, example, okay? So we have the subject, I, comes to visit 1, and we measure, his blood pressure, body weight, and something else, right? So we have 3 different exploratory variables, and we measure all these exploratory variables at each time point. So you can formulate a linear regression model in this way. Yij is equal to beta 1. Sometimes, if you don't see the intercept, it means that the first covariate xij1 is equal to 1. So beta 1 is the intercept. And then you have your different regression coefficients for the different exploratory variables. And then you have the error of epsilon ij. So now if you don't know anything about longitudinal data, okay, and you just do a standard linear regression model, what you will do, basically, you say that all the errors, epsilon ij, are independent and normally distributed with zero mean and variance sigma squared. Now, if you make these assumptions, which is a very strong assumption, and most of the time does not hold for longitudinal data, what is this assumption? Assumptions say that the correlation between the two errors for the same subject at two time points is zero. So the only way you can justify this assumption is that if you have estimated an autocorrelation function, which here you can, which is zero and flat. Okay? So I'm reviewing the ordinal least square because that's what you will do when you will ignore the correlation. And then what we're going to do, we're going to take this exact identical model formulation, but we're going to extend this assumption. Okay, so sorry, we're not going to make this assumption anymore. So this is a formulation of a linear regression model. Now, you can rewrite. Now, if you think about, again, and coming back to a linear model, now, if we basically do not account for the correlation anyway, there is no reason for now, just for reviewing the theory, to keep the two indices, I and J, simply because people are independent. So assuming that you have IJ is the same of having I times J independent measurements, right? So I'm just going to keep a simpler notation for now, which is basically when you don't have any correlation. So what I'm doing here, I'm assuming that I have, again, M individual subjects. So I dropped one index because we are not looking at the correlation for now. I'm just reviewing the linear regression model. So I have a yi is equal to beta 1 xi 1 plus beta p xi p plus epsilon I. Now, here a first notation in terms of product between vectors and bold. Now, every time I use a bold, I mean like this bold here. I mean these are vectors. And so what I did between the first line and the second line, I rewrote the first line in as a product of two vectors. And this is a product of a column vector, so actually this is prime, right? So I take this vector, transpose, and multiply by this vector. And so basically the product is the sum of the product of each pair, okay? So if you take this one, transpose times this, is equal to this times this, plus this times this, that's what you have on the first equation. Okay, so if you don't understand how I go from here to here, take the handout from metric algebra and make sure you have that clear in your mind. And so the epsilon I are normally distributed with zero mean and variance sigma square, and then we have M subjects are independent identically distributed. Now, generally what we do is the first covariance is equal 1, so beta 1 is the intercept. And so we have the expected value of your error, epsilon I, is 0. That's the usual assumption we do in linear regression. After you adjust for the covariance, the error have 0 mean. And then the variance of epsilon I is sigma squared. Now, I can rewrite, again, my entire linear regression model into a matrix form. Okay? So I'm just rewriting the same thing, the same equation in three different ways. And you say, why do we need to do that? Well, because sometimes writing things in matrix form, it's a much more compact way. And in longitudinal data analysis, we will need to write it in matrix form. Otherwise, we will spend, you know, three times of our time to say yij1 plus yi, we don't want to do that, okay? So it's a very nice compact way. So what is this matrix form? Well, capital Y is a vector of dimension n times 1, which is basically y is equal to y1 to yn, okay? X is my design matrix, which is n times p. Basically, it's a matrix which has n row and p columns. So the I row would be xi1, xip. So this will be n times p, p times 1, n times 1. So I basically, you see, you can write this part here. This equation is true for every I. Okay? And actually, sorry guys, this should be m. Okay. So, you see, for each, so if you take this one, each row of this equation here is equal to this, which is also equal to this. So at each I, you can say yi is equal to xi prime beta plus epsilon I. And the only thing I did here, I piled up the equation on top, subject 1, subject 2, subject 3, subject 4, subject n. And that's how I used the matrix form here. So y is a vector m times 1. X is we call design matrix, which is fixed, is the value of our covariance, which has m rows, will have as many rows as the number of subjects, and as many columns as the number of covariates. Beta is the vector of the regression coefficient, and you will have how many betas are the number of covariates, intercept included. And epsilon, mi, is the vector of the errors. Okay. Now, because now epsilon is a vector dimension m, it's not one epsilon I, it's a series of epsilon, we assume that epsilon has to have what we call multivariate normal distribution, because we extend in a multivariate fair fashion the normal distribution, which will have a self-zero mean, and variance of sigma squared I. What is I? I is what we call the independent matrix. I is a matrix, again, M times M, which is the identity matrix, which is the one in the diagonal and has all zeros of the diagonal. Okay? So, and why we have this assumption? Well, because we assume that the correlation between each pair of these guys is zero. So as soon as you go off of the diagonal, the correlation is zero. Now, this is coming up a question to me. How many of you know what is a covariance matrix? Few hands like that. How many of you don't know what is a covariance matrix? Don't be shy. Okay. So what is a covariance matrix? We need to say what is a covariance matrix. So if you have, so, okay, let me step back for a moment, okay? So let me give you the definition of a covariance matrix. Suppose you have a vector of responses, y1, y2, y3, okay? And what you have to do, you have to calculate the covariance matrix of Y. What is the definition of the covariance matrix? Well, will be V, will have a dimension 3 by 3. And it will have on the main diagonal what I call V11, V22, V33. Off the diagonal will be V12, V13, V23. That's actually symmetric, where V11, give me a second, is the variance of Y1, V22 is the variance of Y2, V33 is the variance of Y3, V12 is the covariance between Y1 and Y3. So the covariance is the covariance, okay, so it's equal to V11, V22 times the covariance. Okay, so we will work, now you see there is an additional step because we will have a repeated measurement for each subject will lead not only to one response, but each subject will lead to a vector of responses, which are the repeated measurements for the same subject. Okay? So we will need to deal with a covariance matrix, which is what is a covariance matrix of the vector of the repeated measurements for the same subject. And let's assume for a moment that you have only three measurements. Well, the covariance matrix of Y by definition, will have a dimension 3 times 3, which is the number of the elements of the vector. On the main diagonal, you will have these elements of V11, V22, and V33, which is the variance of the three measurements. Okay? So let's assume you have 100 subjects who come at the first visit, and you calculate the variance of all the subjects at the first visit. And then 100 subjects come at the second visit, you calculate the variance of all the subjects or the measurements of all the subjects second visit. 100 subjects come to the third visit, you calculate the variance of all the measurements of the third visit. And these are the V1, V2, and V3. Off diagonal are what we call the covariances. Okay? So these will be V12 is the covariance between Y1 and Y2. And the covariance is it's equal to the square. So I'm sorry. So the correlation rho 1 2 is equal to the covariance divided by V11 V22. So off the diagonal will be the covariances. And the covariances are basically, it's a transformation of, so the covariance are the square root of the product of the two corresponding variances times the correlation. Okay? So rho 1, 2 is the correlation between the measurements at the first visit and the measurements at the second visit. Okay? And if you take these and you multiply by the square root of the two variances, you get the covariances of the measurements between the first visit and measurements of the second visit. And that is the definition of a covariance matrix. Okay. So now you will need to know what is a covariance matrix. Why? Because one of the important steps of the course will be, your response is not going to be only one measurement anymore. It's going to be a vector of measurements. So if in linear regression, the only thing you have to worry about was the variance of these measurements, now that will not be enough, because you have not only think about the variance at each time point, but you also need to think to worry about the covariances between each pair. Okay? So that's why we need a covariance matrix. Is everyone clear what the covariance matrix is? At least clearer than before, which... So, going back, here, when I make these two assumptions here, I have my vector, which goes y1 to ym, and I assume the variance of y. It's basically done, the covariance matrix is the following one. It's a sigma square, and zero. So if you have a linear regression, if you assume that there is no cross correlation, by assuming that the epsilon, a multivariate normal with zero mean, a covariance matrix sigma square I. So sigma square I is a covariance matrix of a dimension m times m, and because m are the number of elements in my vector y, which has a sigma square in the main diagonal and zero off the diagonal. What does it mean? It means, so by making this assumption, I am assuming that the variance of y1 is equal to the variance of y2 is equal to the variance of ym is always sigma square. By saying that it's zero, I say that the covariance between y1 and y2, y1 and y3, or y0 is always zero. So think about how strong is the assumption that we make when we do a linear regression model. We assume that So if we have a longitudinal data, okay, and if we see the standard linear regression model, we are saying that at each time point, the variance of the measurements is always the same, and the covariances between each pair of measurements, independently of what is the time lag, is always zero. Okay? So the reason why we're going to take this course is because we are going to account for much more fancy and complicated representation of the covariance matrices. Because we will allow, so if you have an autocorrelation function, so let's think it through. We'll go this again and again many times. Let's assume that the autocorrelation function decreases as the lag differences increase. It means that you have weaker correlation as large as the time difference. Well, the off-diagonal element of these metrics will tell you what is the covariance between Y1 and Y2. And here's going to tell you what is the covariance between Y1 and Ym. If the autocorrelation function decay, what you want to do, you want to assume that the covariances here are higher than the covariances here. Okay? So that's why looking at this plot will inform us how to model the covariance match. Now, what I'm doing here, I'm just showing you that if you have a longitudinal data set, but you just simply do ordinal least square, you are making a very specific assumption of your covariance matrix, which is this one. Okay? So actually, on your last slide, I'm just rewriting what I just said. So the fact that you can rewrite your linear regression models in matrix form, and you can say that the single epsilon I are independent, identical, distributed, if and only if you take the entire vector of epsilon, which has a multivariate normal distribution, which this is our covariance matrix, and the covariance matrix is a sigma squared on the main diagonal and zero on sat. So that is what you will assume, for example, if you have only one measurement for each subject, you assume that different subjects are independent. So, you know, you can read this in absence of longitudinal data. You can just say that the covariance between the measurements of one subject and another subject is basically zero. So, now going back to the standard review of a linear model. So, well, most of you know that the linear model is put as a special case, the analysis of variance, when the xij are binary, multiple regression, where the xij are continuous, the analysis of covariance, where the xij are dummy continuous. And so beta, the regression coefficient, is the expected value of the responsive variable y per unit change of its corresponding explanatory variable x, having all other variables been fixed. Okay, that is just a general review of now, this is another tricky thing. So, being honest, how many of you have never heard of what is a Lattice function before? Oh, that's good. Okay, so then, well, let me go through one moment anyway. So, we talk about likelihood inference, and we will need to do that. It's basically, we start with likelihood of inference by specifying what is the sampling distribution of your data. And in case of linear regression model, we assume that the sampling distribution is normal. So likelihood inference is based on the specification of the probability density of the observed data, which is our F of Y theta. And so basically, we write our sampling distribution as a function of our model parameters, which is our L theta or y. So it's basically you take the sampling distribution, but then you look at the sampling distribution as function of your unknown parameter theta, which most of the time is our unknown regression coefficient. And as we have a likelihood function, which is basically a likelihood function is that for each value of my unknown parameter theta, it tells you how much that particular value is supported by our data. Okay? And so what you want to do, you want to find the maximal likelihood, you want to find the estimate of your unknown parameter, which is maximally supported by the data. You don't want to estimate a parameter with a particular value if that is the one which the probability, the conditional to the data that we have, the value is the true value, it's almost zero. It doesn't make any sense. And that's what we call maximal likelihood estimation. So theta f is regarded as the value of theta, which is most strongly supported by the data. And how you maximize the likelihood function? Well, in mathematics, every time we have a function and we want to maximize, we take the first derivative. Most of the time here, we take the first log derivative. The first derivative of the log likelihood, and we solve this equation. So find the maximum likelihood estimate is equivalent of solving this equation, which is taking the first derivative of the log likelihood equal to zero, and that is called a score equation. And the reason why we take the log, remember, every time you want to maximize a function and you take a monotone transformation, then the maximum is always the same. It doesn't change. So that's why maximizing a function or maximizing a monotone transformation of that function basically gives you the same results. So we will see that most of the time, calculating the log likelihood is much easier to maximize. So three concepts. It's sampling distribution. When our data are continuous, most of the time, the sampling distribution is the normal density. If you have a sampling distribution, and then you take the sampling distribution as a function of your unknown parameter, that's called the likelihood function, which basically gives you the weight of evidence for each of the value of your unknown parameter. The goal is to maximize the likelihood function. How you maximize the likelihood function? By solving the score equation. Okay, so I'm using a lot of terminology, but that is the themes that will return through all the course. So let's have an example. Okay, so let's look if this will look less obscure. Okay, so let's assume you have your standard linear regression model, yi equals to xi prime beta plus epsilon i are independent identical distributed normal sigma square I equal 1 to m. Okay? Is everyone with me with what I wrote with my blue pen? Okay? Linear regression model. What do you do when you do a linear regression model? You assume that epsilon I is a normal 0 sigma square. By doing so, you are saying that the sampling distribution is normal. Right? And so here, the only thing I did, I expressed in my sampling distribution, which will be minus 1 divided 2 pi sigma square root. That is just the expression of a normal density function of yi, and this is the mean, xi prime beta, and this is the variance. Okay? So, by the first equation here, by saying this is equivalent to say the yi are normally distributed with mean x prime beta and variance sigma square. Okay, so the first line I wrote is equivalent to the second line that I wrote. And what you have in the slide by g is basically the normal density. Let's assume for now that I know sigma, okay? So sigma square is known. The only thing I care about is estimating my regression coefficient beta, okay? So how I write the likelihood function? First, I take my sampling distribution, which is a normal density. Then I take the product of this normal density across all the m subjects. The m subjects are independent, and that's what I did here. This guy here, as a function of beta, is the likelihood function for beta. Okay? So what I did then So I want to maximize the likelihood function, so then I can get the maximum likelihood estimate for beta. So because it is a little complicated, what I do, I first calculate the log likelihood. So I take this quantity and I calculate the log. So the log of a product is the sum. And then I calculate the log of each component. You see that is a minus 1/2 log of this guy, minus 1/2 of this guy. And that is equal to what? Now, I have to maximize this function with respect to beta. So all the elements of this function that doesn't depend on beta, I don't care. So what I do, I basically say, this part is just a constant. I don't care. It doesn't bother me because I know sigma squared. And the only thing I have to do, I have to maximize this part. Okay, well, maximizing something with a minus, so maximizing the log likelihood is equivalent to minimizing the sum of squares. I'm just reviewing what you have done with ordinal least squares. So beta hat, which is also maximum likelihood estimate, under normal linear regression model, is the solution of the minimizer of the sum of squares. Okay, so what we have done, we started from a linear regression model with an assumption about normal error. We have a sampling distribution. We calculate the likelihood function, calculate the log likelihood. We maximize the log likelihood, which is minimizing the sum of squares, and we found the ordinal least square estimate. Sounds easy, right? Now, there are different interpretations. There is also what is called the geometry. When you get the ordinal least square, which is also a maximum likelihood estimate, you can also find it by doing what is called the geometry of least square. It's just a different concept. So basically, you have the same design metrics. And so remember, what we need to do is that we wanted to minimize it. We wanted to minimize the sum of square. And basically, you can rewrite the sum of square as the cross product of two vectors. So basically, you can rewrite these as the length of this vector, which is the distance between x of beta and y. So another way to look at the problem is that to choose our beta so that the distance from y to x of beta is as small as possible. So we have our y, we have x of beta, and minimizing a sum of square is basically equivalent to minimizing the length of the vector of y minus x beta, which is basically to find the beta such that the distance from y to x to beta is as small as possible, which makes sense, right? You want to find the beta such that x of beta predicts y as best as you can. Well, how you do that? Well, if you want to minimize the distance, a way to minimize the distance is basically to say that this y minus x of beta f is orthogonal to x. And so basically, saying that this vector is orthogonal to this vector is basically to assume that x prime y minus x beta is zero. Actually, I have it here too. So you see, the method of least square is that the beta f that minimize the length of the residual vector. So the beta hat that minimize the length of the residual vector y minus x beta f makes y minus x beta f orthogonal to the space, we call it the space spanned by our design metrics. So basically what we need to do is to solve this equation, say that x prime y minus x prime x beta f is equal to zero, which means that x prime x beta f is equal to x prime y. And then solve beta f is x prime x inverse x prime y. And that is called ordinally least square. Okay? What is the dimension here? So remember that x is m times p. So this one is going to be P times M, M times 1, P times M, M times P. So this is a P times 1. So our beta, I'm doing it for the entire vector of regression coefficient beta, right? So to conclude, okay, I just show you how you get to an estimate of ordinal least square under a linear regression model. I complicated your life a little bit because I need to introduce some matrix notation up front. So I'm just revisiting the theory of ordinal least square estimation using a matrix formulation. Okay? And I show you that when you want to define an ordinal least square estimate, is either a maximum likelihood under the assumption of a normal linear model, or I also show you that you can get to the same solution by minimizing the sum of square with the usual interpretation of the geometry of least square. Okay. Now you should be able with the 620, the 650 series, I'm sure you have covered the material. So between now and Wednesday, just revisit and refresh your mind with respect to the following thing. A little bit of matrix algebra, you have the handout to the website. The definition of a covariance matrix, which I gave you here, and which I'm assuming it's some of the lab handouts, but definitely in your textbook. What is a linear regression model? What is a likelihood function? What is ordinal least square? Okay? So I have the five points I told you at the beginning. So please review the material, and then we will continue Wednesday. Thank you.